Welcome back to Obscura, where the veil lifts on the unspoken horrors that lurk in the everyday. In part one, we trace the fractured paths that led three lives to collide in a storm of jealousy and control. Now, in this second installment, we descend into the abyss of that fateful night, unraveling the brutal mechanics of betrayal, the relentless pursuit of truth by those left behind, and the cold hand of justice that sought to balance the scales. Brace yourself as we confront the raw edges of human darkness, where whispers turn to screams and consequences echo eternally. All right, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
You promised me. I can't live like this.
Well, are you going to push this or what?
You're not going to do that, Josh. You're going to kill me when you get up there.
I have.
What did Amelia tell you? Did she get to go home?
Mm-hmm. Yes, she did.
How come she got to go home and I can't?
Maybe she was a little bit more honest. See how that works.
I'm going to tell you what, this is what I was told. Right here. I was told she was gone, leave it alone. That's what I was told, that she's gone to leave it alone.
I'm telling you, he told me that you told him that. Okay? We know that he brought her back to the house that night.
What house? I was home that night.
Listen, your heart is about to jump out of your chest.
Because I was home at my mom's.
Your heart is about to jump out of your chest.
That pisses me off.
Okay. Don't do this to yourself.
But what I...
Don't do this to yourself.
Ask my mom. I was home
Don't do
that
this
night.
To yourself.
What is he saying I did?
That you set it up.
During Joshua's incarceration in January 2009, Amelia spent time with Jason Lotshaw and Acombe, friends from her earlier years. On a trip to the store to buy diapers, Amelia offered $500 to Lotshaw and Acombe if they would get Heather Strong drunk, allowing Amelia to kill her by snapping her neck. James Acombe's sister-in-law, Christy Stover, met Amelia after she moved into the trailer park. Stover's younger brother was close friends with Joshua Folgham. In January, while Joshua was in jail, Amelia called Stover multiple times. Amelia expressed frustration, believing Heather had falsely accused Joshua of assault and rape, leading to his imprisonment. She declared her love for Joshua and her desire for his release. Amelia offered $500 for someone to kill Heather, stating she would do it herself but could not handle moving the body because of her advanced pregnancy. Stover did not take the offer seriously. Amelia had recently received her income tax refund upon his release from the Marion County Jail on February 6, 2009. After serving time for aggravated assault, Joshua Folgham made his way to the modest home of his mother, Judy Chandler, in a quiet, wooded section of the county where trailers and small houses dotted the landscape like forgotten relics. The air was thick with the damp chill of late winter in Florida, the kind that seeps into the bones and lingers, mirroring the unresolved tensions in Folgham's life. Chandler's residence provided a temporary haven, a place where Folgham could regroup amid the clutter of everyday domesticity. But it was far from peaceful. The shadows of his volatile relationship with Strong loomed large in his mind, compounded by his ongoing entanglement with Amelia Carr. 9 days later, on the afternoon of Sunday, February 15th, Chandler, at her son's behest, drafted a custody letter. a stark handwritten document intended for Heather to sign, relinquishing primary care of their two young children, Mackenzie and Zachary, to Falgum. She penned the words, unaware of the sinister role it would play in the unfolding tragedy. Later that day, as the sun dipped low, casting long shadows over the driveway gravel, Chandler returned home to witness Falgum and Strong pulling away in their car, their figures receding into the distance like a fleeting illusion. Entering the house, she found the children left behind, their small faces peering up with innocent confusion, abandoned without explanation in the dim living room light.
Josh is saying,
because he asked me about it, and I told him, I said, Josh, don't you think if I'd have pulled a knife on her, I'd be sitting on the other side of county jail?
Say the reason why you didn't, the reason why she didn't, is because you're pregnant, and she didn't want to see you go to jail with that baby.
And I highly doubt that, because if anything, she didn't want me to have this baby.
Yeah, and now I don't know what else to tell you. I don't know where she's at, man. I don't. I just want to sleep. And get up.
So you're telling me Amelia knows, she knows everything.
What we want you to do is listen to us right now, okay? Don't say anything. Obviously, you know what's going on. You have been in here since last night, answering questions, telling us lies, telling us the truth, telling us lies back and forth, okay? That stops here, okay? We found Heather, okay? She's obviously murdered, okay? We've been speaking with Josh all night, okay? We've been listening, letting you listen to some of the things he's been saying, and we've been telling him some of the things you've been saying, okay? That's not an attempt to play you one against the other. It's an attempt to get the truth out of two people that are lying to us very much, okay? I want to tell you how you stand right now, okay? You don't stand so well, okay? Because everything is pointing to Amelia, and I'm going to explain that to you, and I want you to listen to me. And I'll next ask any questions, okay? What I've done is just made a little cheat sheet here for myself, okay? We have Amelia, that's you in the middle, okay? And these are all the things that are against Amelia, okay? The body was found in your property, okay, where you're living. We have Heather, okay? Obviously, she's deceased. But Josh was gonna go back with her, the father of your baby, okay? We have Chrissy. And we have James involved, okay? Chrissy's like, yeah, you know, she held a knife to her throat, pulled her hair and all that stuff. Don't deny it, don't admit it, okay? Because I don't want to lie out of your mouth until you hear what I have to say, okay? But I still have everything pointing to you.
Yeah.
I can put you in prison for the rest of your life just with this evidence, okay? I can. But I need to give Amelia a chance because you've been lying to us all night. You've been telling us the truth here. You've been telling us lies there. Okay? That stops right now because Amelia and her baby are being affected now.
Yeah, and I've been trying to make an effort with Detective Bowie with the phone calls.
Okay. You're being affected now, okay? Because you don't want your baby born in prison. We don't want your baby born in prison, okay? And I'm not saying that's where you're going to end up, okay? But if I have to use all this stuff against you, you're the only suspect that I have right now that can win in court, okay? So I want to know from you exactly what happened. No more of this, I think, or I heard, or nothing. I want the truth, okay? The truth starts right now, because now we ain't playing, okay? You never met me before. You have to trust me, okay? You have to trust this man, too. He's been doing this a lot longer than I have. He's been doing it 30 years. I've been doing it 20 years, okay? Stops today.
I don't want to go to prison.
We don't want you to either, okay?
But I can hand you Josh on a silver platter.
Okay, well, let's get through this, okay? And keep your kids in your mind and in your mind.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I can tell you everything that I know.
Okay. Are you willing to do that?
I don't want to. I want immunity. I will testify. I will.
Let's hear what you have to say first. I can't promise you nothing.
Yeah, well, see, that's what
Well, let me just explain this to you.
I want something to where I'm not going to take you from my babies.
Well, we ain't going to take you from your babies, and we're not going to take your babies from you. Okay.
Falgum reappeared around 8:30 or 9 that night. The darkness outside now complete. Clutching the purportedly signed custody document, Chandler scrutinized the signature, her eyes narrowing in skepticism. It lacked the familiar loops and flourishes of Strong's hand. A forgery that screamed of deception, though Folgum insisted otherwise, with a fervor that bordered on menace. 2 days later, Chandler and Folgum wielded this dubious paper to enroll McKenzie in a nearby school. The administrative process unfolding in a sterile office, where no one questioned the ink's authenticity. That same day, Amelia Carr moved into Chandler's home with Folgum, her pregnancy evident in the swell of her belly. The trio cohabiting the cramped quarters thick with unspoken rivalries. A week or so later, they relocated to a nearby trailer park, the move a hasty shuffle of belongings under overcast skies, leaving behind an air of unease that clung to the walls like stale smoke. Across state lines in Mississippi, Misty Strong, Heather's cousin and a steadfast link to her roots, felt a growing knot of worry tighten in her chest. As days passed by without a word from Heather, the two had grown up like sisters in the humid, close-knit communities of their youth, sharing secrets and hardships. Misty knew all too well the controlling grip Folgum held over Heather, how he isolated her, denying her a cell phone or computer access, severing ties to family, as if pruning branches from a tree. Phone calls were unanswered, messages vanished into silence, until on February 24th, Misty could bear it no longer and contacted the Marion County Sheriff's Office, her voice steady but edged with fear as she reported Heather missing.
See, it's hard because we're trying to understand. I'm trying to understand what you're going to tell me, okay? A lot of what you can tell me, we're going to know if it's the truth or not, okay? Yeah. I don't think that... I hope that you don't think that you would be sitting here having this conversation with us if we wasn't thinking anything different, okay? No. All's we're after is the truth.
I understand that.
Just the truth of who killed her, okay?
Well, I didn't kill her, but I can tell you details and I can tell you things about everything.
I bet you can, okay?
But I'm just saying.
If you didn't kill her, okay, and you tell us... And we believe you, okay? We can't put you in jail for something you did.
Well, after Detective Bowie played me that tape, that's when I told him when we go out to the house, every time he calls, I want it on speaker, and I want you to hear what he has to say. And I've been asking the questions Detective Bowie wanted me to ask him. I'm trying to help. I don't want to be taken from my kids. Okay. I can tell you details that you guys probably already know. I can tell you everything that happened to her.
So if you think we already know that stuff and we haven't arrested you, what does that tell you?
Deputy Billings took the lead, her investigation beginning with a methodical canvas of Heather's known associates. She interviewed James Acombe, Heather's recent boyfriend, who recounted their shared apartment and the abrupt disappearance on February 15th, his account laced with confusion and concern. From there, the trail led to Folgum's volatile history with Heather, including the January arrest for aggravated assault. Conversations with friends and coworkers painted a picture of escalating discord, culminating on a be-on-the-lookout alert for a missing 26-year-old. Her description disseminated across law enforcement channels like a grim wanted poster for the vanished.
I come across Heather.
Where?
Duct taped to the little blue chair.
In the trailer.
In the trailer. And I freak out. I check for a pulse. I'm looking to see if she's breathing. And I'm just checking. And I walked out. And he was there later that afternoon. I asked him, what the hell did you do? He told me that in the middle of the night, after we were in bed, he brought her there. And I guess he told her that he knew where I had money stashed to get her to go back there. And that he basically... He hit her upside the head with something, and she was trying to leave, and she broke the window, and he left her there because he didn't know what to do with her, how to dispose of her. And I told him, I want nothing to do with this. Get her the hell off my mom's property.
Okay, this is on your mom's property?
Yes.
Okay.
And this is Monday morning?
No, this is Monday afternoon when he got off work that he came out there, that he had asked my mom for a shovel because he told her he had a dog. And I told him I wanted nothing to do with it, and I walked out, and I told him, if you don't do something, I'm going to call the cops. And what he did after that, I don't know.
When you checked her pulse,
there was nothing. She was cold.
Was she sitting in a chair?
She was duct taped. To a chair.
What color chair?
It's the only one in that little kitchen area. It's a little blue chair.
Okay.
And I told him, I said, you got to do something. I said, I don't want this crap here. I said, Josh, I don't know what the hell's gotten into you, but you need to do something. And he asked my mom for a shovel. What he did, I didn't think he would bury her on my mother's property.
Let me tell you about Chime. They're changing the way people bank. And honestly, my younger self would have benefited from this. Chime isn't just another banking app, listener. They've built smarter, fee-free banking for everyday people, not the 1%. Forget overdraft fees. Forget monthly fees. Forget minimum balance fees. With Chime, that's all gone. Here's what makes them different. With MyPay, you can access up to $500 of your paycheck anytime and get paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. They've also got this new Chime card, which lets you build credit history with your own money while earning cash back on everyday spending. No annual fees, no interest, no strings attached. Plus, you can earn up to 3% APY on savings. That's 8 times higher than traditional banks. If you ever need help, they've got 5-star rated customer service with real humans available 24/7. Chime is not just smarter banking. It's the most rewarding way to bank. Join the millions who are already banking fee-free today. And it just takes a few minutes to sign up. Head to chime.com/obscura. That is chime.com/obscura.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services, a secured Chime Visa credit card, and MyPay line of credit provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. MyPay eligibility requirements apply, and credit limit ranges $20 to $500. Optional services and products may have fees or charges. See chime.com/fees info. Advertised annual percentage yield with Chime Plus status only. Otherwise, 1.00% APY applies. No min balance required. Chime card on-time payment history may have a positive impact on your credit score. Results may vary. See chime.com for details and applicable terms.
February brings a lot of pressure around relationships. Everywhere you look, flowers, candy, couples holding hands. If your love life doesn't look like a greeting card, it's easy to feel like you're falling behind. And here's the truth. Most of us are still figuring it out, listener. Whether you're in a relationship, dating, or flying solo, you're right on time. There's no perfect timeline for matters of the heart. Therapy can help you see more clearly what you actually want, what's weighing you down, and how to take some of the pressure off yourself. BetterHelp connects you with fully licensed therapists and their matching system. Built on over 12 years of experience, it helps pair you with someone who fits your needs. If it's not the right fit, you could switch anytime. With over 30,000 therapists and a 4.9 out of 5 rating from more than 1.7 million client reviews, they've helped over 6 million people find their way. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That is BetterHelp.com.
I mean, that's just sick. I mean, it's bad enough what he had done, but to do that and make it look the way it's looking now is just not okay. Mm-hmm. And he told me, if you tell anybody, I'll make sure you go down with me and you'll be right next to her. Right next to her.
Okay.
So why didn't you tell us the truth at the beginning? Why didn't you tell us?
Because I was scared.
You were scared.
I mean, like I told you, I have kids. I mean, I've seen people go to prison for knowing stuff.
Yes. She started down the hall. Maybe that's when Mia hit her. She went back and went into that window with her hand. And when she did, I grabbed her and I put her in a chair. And I held her down on the chair.
Was she fighting then?
Well, she really couldn't, man. I asked her a little bitty self.
So the adrenaline was flowing.
And I just held her. I made a taper. She had her arm around her neck. She was trying to snap her neck. She had this hand right here was coming over her head, over her nose.
And where were you?
I was still sitting on her. And I knew that Heather had got weak, I could tell she was getting weak. Because she was just like, then, nothing.
Fulgham himself was questioned. His responses evasive, his demeanor a mask of feigned ignorance that did little to dispel suspicion. As March unfolded, the investigation intensified, with Amelia Carr drawn into the web of scrutiny. Starting on March 18, 2009, detectives at the Marion County Sheriff's Office conducted a series of interviews, shuffling her between interrogation rooms in her home. The back and forth, a disorienting rhythm that wore on her resolve. While Amelia faced questions in one sterile space, Fulgham occupied another. The parallel sessions allowing detectives to cross-reference statements, like pieces of a fractured puzzle. Some exchanges occurred over the phone, Amelia initiating calls that added incriminating layers to her evolving narrative. Initially, she professed complete ignorance of Heather's fate, her words a flat denial delivered in the fluorescent lit confines of the station. Armed with details gleaned from Fulgham's interviews, detectives pressed her relentlessly, their voices insistent, urging truth amid the mounting contradictions. Gradually, Amelia cracked, admitting that Fulgham had appeared at her bedroom window in the early hours of February 16th, whispering declarations of love before confessing to Heather's murder in the storage trailer parked at the rear of her mother's property, where Amelia resided with her children. She claimed initial disbelief, dismissing the words as bluster, especially his macabre assertion that alligators in nearby Orange Lake would consume the body, erasing all evidence in the murky waters. Meanwhile, Fulgham, now under arrest, bargained with authorities, offering to guide them to the burial site in exchange for considerations. On March 19th, he led a team to the property owned by Amelia's mother, the ground soft underfoot from recent rains. With consent from the owner and a search warrant secured, shovels broke earth where he indicated, unearthing Heather Strong's decomposing remains from a shallow grave. The body bloated and reeking after weeks of exposure to the elements. The discovery confirmed the worst, her identity verified through dental records and other markers, the scene a tableau of horror amid the rural quietude. Dr. Barbara Wolf, the district medical examiner, conducted the autopsy in the cold, clinical confines of the morgue, her tools dissecting the ravaged form to uncover the cause. The examination revealed scant physical trauma, a bruise on the forehead, 2 inches wide, inflicted by blunt force, consistent with a flashlight strike, but non-lethal, merely a superficial wound that had oozed blood and life. No definitive cause emerged from the body alone, the decomposition masking finer details. Toxicology showed a blood alcohol level of 0.099, indicating intoxication, but not fatality. Evidence from the grave and trailer yielded no direct physical ties to Amelia. No fingerprints, DNA, or fiber linking her unequivocally, though remnants of duct tape clung to the clothing, silent witnesses to the binding. Undeterred, detectives persisted with Amelia's interviews, her hints of withheld knowledge dangling like bait. She repeatedly bartered for immunity, positioning herself as a mere witness, not participant, in exchange for deeper revelations. Expanding her story, she described Fulgham's post-murder warning not to venture to the back of the property, a directive that piqued her curiosity. Venturing into the trailer, she claimed to discover Heather's body, bound with duct tape to a chair, a sight that prompted her to berate Fulgham upon his return, demanding he dispose of it. She supposedly expressed shock at the backyard burial, insisting she never anticipated such proximity. Fulgham, she said, had lured Heather with promises of hidden money, confronting her about fleeing with the children before killing her. Amelia added that Fulgham phoned her the night of the murder, outlining his plan, drawing her further into complicity. To extract more, law enforcement enlisted Fulgham's sister, Michelle Gustafson, who agreed to wear a wire for a recorded conversation. On a drive to a county park, the engine humming softly, Gustafson prodded Amelia, who gradually unraveled the tale.
It's just a mess, Amelia. I mean, it's breaking my heart.
He shouldn't be in there, and I'm telling you right now,
I want the true story from you. You gotta tell me the truth so I can help you and Josh. Man, please tell me your side.
What did he tell you? And did he tell you over recorded phones? Please tell him to keep his mouth shut and to keep his head up because everything's going to be okay. I don't know when, but he's got to stop talking to them.
I can't sleep. I can't eat. I hadn't ate since Wednesday. So I want detail.
I don't know if you can hear that, Michelle.
Amelia, it would be better. It would be better knowing than not knowing.
We tried to snap her neck. That didn't work.
You did.
He didn't see any other way out, Michelle. I mean, how many more times was he around?
But why would you try to break her neck?
That's going to be quick and painless.
There was a recorder in her car. There was a microphone in her car so we could listen to you. We didn't just stumble across that car sitting in the park.
Yeah, I know.
Okay? We heard everything. Now, let's go back to what I was just saying. You have shown no remorse. I'm not trying to be mean, but quite frankly, so far, you have shown that you're acting like a cold-hearted, hateful person who killed the mother of two children, okay?
Because I don't cry?
No, because you sit right here, stone cold, and stare in that man's face and lie to his face. After you told that girl today, you tried to break her neck, and it didn't work.
You remember that? Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Remember those words? It came from whose mouth?
Mine.
Let's start over. And I'm going to quit talking. I don't have anything more to say.
Tell me what happened.
I did what I was told to do.
Tell me what happened.
What good is it going to do me to think about it?
Tell me what happened. I want to hear from you. Get that burden off your back. Tell me what happened. You've already admitted to it. You've gotten over that hurdle. You have admitted to killing someone.
No, I admitted to it. Attempted, and it didn't work. He killed her.
Were you there?
On the record?
Everything from here on out is on the record. You were there when she died.
I did what I was told to do.
Tell me what you did then.
Let me tell you this. As much as Josh has told us, which is a lot, he still says that you were the one who killed her.
I killed her.
Okay. I wasn't there. I don't know. I can tell through our investigation and all the people we've talked to, and all sifting through every single lie. Josh has thrown plenty of them up there. You've thrown plenty of them up there. I know you were there, okay? I don't know who killed her at that moment that she died, but I do know y'all were both standing in that room. Is that right? Then if you have something to say that's not the same as what Josh said.
Excuse me.
Now's the time.
Don't give us that respect. Don't nod. Is that right?
Yeah, but on tape.
Is that right? I'm not talking to you in sign language.
I know.
I'm talking to you person to person, respectively. I don't want to assume that you nodded your head, but is that right that you were there with Josh when Heather took her last breath? I can't hear you.
Yes.
What did you guys do after she took her last breath?
Can I ask you something?
Can you answer
if
that
I
for me?
Stop
can you answer
answering
that?
Questions. You're just gonna go ahead and arrest me, right? There's no way I'm going home tonight.
You keep looking at what you're sitting in here doing, and you keep thinking that this is what's getting you in trouble.
No,
okay. What's getting you in trouble is the night of February 15th. Okay? This is why this all started. From here on out, you've got a decision to make. You can still play these games and still try to weasel out of whatever you think you can weasel out of, or you can take the right path. And the right path is sitting in here saying, you know what? I did something wrong. If I had the chance to take it back, I would, but I can't. So you know what? Here's what happened. I apologize. If I could take it back, I would. I'm sorry. So far, the only thing you've done here is tried to save your own behind, even though you killed a woman.
I didn't kill her.
Yes, you did.
Then tell me what happened. Because Josh says you did it. After you tried to break her neck and couldn't do it, you killed her.
I did not kill her.
Show me something different then. Because Josh has been telling us the truth for several days.
I was scared shitless.
Was anyone stopping you from running out that door?
Fear?
Was anyone stopping you from running out that door?
Fear, but I guess that doesn't count, huh?
No, it does not, sweetheart. I'm sorry.
But I just wish that you had taken this direction, but I was fucking scared.
Tell me what you think you're guilty of.
I don't think I'm lost.
I'm sorry? Of being a monster?
Of helping a monster.
I didn't understand.
Helping a monster.
Oh, helping a monster. Do you want anything to drink? Do you need to use the restroom? Are you okay?
No.
Are you hurting? I guess I should ask that because I know that you're not okay. Are you physically okay? Huh?
How long before you guys take me over to be booked?
We're going to do the paperwork right now. Okay?
Confronted with the recording at the sheriff's office, Amelia aligned her account, admitting presence, inaction, and assistance under Fulghum's orders, confessing as a principal, piecing confessions, documents, testimonies, and autopsy. The horror became clarified.
I received a call from your mom.
Yeah.
That you want to talk to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Any reason why you didn't send a request form?
I did.
Okay.
But I had called my mom first and then did the request form. So
okay.
You'll be getting that.
Okay.
I don't know when.
Okay. But you do want to talk to me.
Mm.
Okay. Without the presence of your attorney.
Mm. I just saw my attorney not too long ago.
Well, before I can speak with you about anything you want to talk about, we have to go through the same stuff we went through
before.
I
know.
Okay.
I just kind of wanted to run some things by you off the
record. Well, nothing is off the record.
I know.
Okay? Nothing is off the record. This is very, very serious.
I know.
Okay. Now, if you want to tell me something, I'm here to listen to you. But understand that I'm going to do my job correctly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make sure you know your rights. Okay?
My attorney's gonna be pissed I'm talking to you without her here.
That's your choice.
Okay.
Listener, we're all trying to get healthier, buying supplements, following the latest workout trends. But what if the newest tip from your favorite health influencer isn't exactly what your body needs? True Diagnostic helps you find out the exact supplements and lifestyle changes that can make a difference. And which ones might just be wasting your money? I just took the test myself. The kit arrived at my door. I did a quick, simple finger prick at home, then dropped it in the prepaid return package. That's it. Now I'm waiting on my results. Should have them in a few weeks. And I'm genuinely curious to see what my biological age looks like versus my actual age and what specific changes I should make. True Diagnostic uses advanced epigenetic testing to analyze over 1 million biomarkers. Their True Age test measures how fast you're actually aging across 11 organ systems. True Health tests over 100 biomarkers like vitamins, inflammation, and metabolism, or get the combo for both. Either way, you get a clear 90-day plan. Your only job? Follow the three most important actions you can take for 90 days. Then retest to see your progress. This is trusted by top longevity clinics and health professionals, not just consumers at home. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off at TrueDiagnostic.com using code Obscura20 at checkout. That's TrueDiagnostics.com and use code Obscura20 for 20% off today. Choose True Age, True Health, or the Combo Kit as a one-time purchase or subscription. Listener, after spending hours researching the darkest corners of true crime, sometimes you need something to help you decompress. That's where Mood comes in. Mood.com is an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC products right to your door. We're talking gummies, flower, pre-rolls, edibles. They've got products designed for specific vibes. Need to wind down after a heavy episode? They've got sleepy time gummies. Want something for focus during those long research sessions? They've got that too. They even have options for feeling euphoric or, let's say, enhancing other activities. Personally, I'm a fan of their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies. They kick in fast and actually help quiet my brain, After a long day of diving into cases, everything ships discreetly. It's all backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And best of all, Obscura listeners get 20% off their first order. Head to mood.com and use code Obscura at checkout for 20% off. That's mood.com with code Obscura.
You want to talk to me?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the dim flickering candlelight of a cluttered storage trailer, tucked away in rural Boardman, Florida, on the evening of February 15, 2009, Heather Strong found herself ensnared in a deadly trap orchestrated by her ex-partner, Joshua Folgham, and his pregnant lover, Amelia Carr. Lured there under the false promise of retrieving some cash, the 26-year-old mother of two walked into what would become her final agonizing moments, a scene pieced together from court testimonies, confessions, and forensic evidence that painted a picture of calculated betrayal laced with raw violence. The air in the trailer hung heavy with tension as Folgham confronted Strong about custody papers for their children, his voice sharp and accusatory. She had barely settled into the space, surrounded by haphazard piles of junk and the faint metallic tang of duct tape rolls scattered about, when the attack began. Folgham, fueled by simmering rage over past grievances, grabbed her and forced her into a small blue computer chair, his grip unyielding as he held her down with a superior strength. Carr, 7 months pregnant and driven by jealousy over Folgham's lingering ties to Strong, joined in without hesitation, ripping strips of gray duct tape from a nearby roll. They worked in tandem, wrapping the sticky bands tightly around Strong's wrists, binding them to the chair's arms, then securing her ankles together and her chest to the backrest. Layer after layer, until she could barely twitch, Strong's claustrophobia surged. She begged them not to tape her, her voice cracking with panic as the adhesive pulled at her skin and restricted her breathing even before the worst came. But restraint was only the prelude. As Strong sobbed, asking, "Josh, why?" and pleading with Carr for mercy, "Help me, please." Carr positioned herself behind the chair, her hands clamping around Strong's neck in a brutal attempt to snap it. She twisted hard, once, then twice, aiming for what she later described in confessions as a quick and painless end. But Strong's body resisted, her muscles tensing in desperate survival instinct. Carr's hands shook with the effort, her grip slipping on sweat-slick skin, failing to deliver the fatal crack. Frustration mounted. Strong thrashed wildly, her cries muffled but piercing, echoing off the trailer's thin walls as Carr's hands attempted to snap her neck, jerking it over and over. In the chaos, she managed a brief surge of strength, knocking the pregnant Carr to the ground and shattering a small window in a frantic bid for escape, glass shards scattering. Terror overwhelmed her. She urinated on herself, the warm liquid soaking through her jeans, as Folgham dragged her back to the chair, his eyes glazed with fury. He struck her hard on the forehead with a flashlight, the impact splitting the device and leaving a 2-inch bruise that oozed blood, her scalp throbbing with each heartbeat. With Strong subdued once more, the pair escalated to suffocation. Carr grabbed a black plastic garbage bag from the trailer's clutter, thin, crinkling material that rustled ominously in her hands, and stretched it over Strong's head, pulling it down to envelop her face completely. The bag clung to her skin like a second, suffocating layer, fogging with her frantic breaths as she gasped for air that wouldn't come. Folgham tightened it further, his fingers pressing the edges against her neck, while Carr handed him more duct tape to seal the horror in place. They wrapped it around her throat in tight coils, the tape biting into her flesh, compressing her windpipe and ensuring no sliver of oxygen could slip through. For an added measure, Folgham clamped his hand over her covered nose and mouth, feeling the desperate heaves of her chest beneath the restraints. Strong's world narrowed to pure agony in those final minutes, estimated by medical examiners at around 5 excruciating ones, where she remained fully conscious, Her lungs burned with a futile pull for air, each inhale drawing the plastic tighter against her lips and nostrils, the material sucking inward like a vacuum of death. She squirmed and bucked against the tape, her body convulsed in waves of panic, the chair creaking under the strain as her muffled whimpers turned to gurgles. Blood from her head wound trickled down, mixing with sweat and tears inside the bag. Her vision blurring as oxygen deprivation set in, her mind racing with the horrifying realization that escape was impossible. The trailer filled with the stench of fear and exertion, her bladder already emptied, now joined by the metallic scent of blood. Slowly, her struggles weakened. Her body went limp, slumping forward with her head lolling to the side. The bag still plastered to her lifeless face. Fulgham peeled back the tape to check. No pulse, no breath. It confirmed that the deed was done. In the aftermath, they wrapped her head in a blanket, stuffed her cooling body into a suitcase, and buried it in a shallow grave nearby, where it decomposed for weeks until discovery on March 19th. Bloated and reeking, with duct tape remnants clinging to her clothes and DNA linking back to the scene. Carr's confession, given repeatedly to detectives and captured in undercover recordings, revealed her cold admission. Amelia Carr's trial for the kidnapping and first-degree murder of Heather Strong commenced on November 30, 2010, in Marion County, Florida. Following jury selection, with Circuit Judge Willard Pope presiding, prior to the trial, Carr had refused a plea deal offered by the prosecution that would have resulted in a life sentence without the possibility of parole, opting instead to proceed to trial where the state sought the death penalty. The guilt phase concluded on December 7, 2010, after approximately 2.5 hours of deliberations, with the jury finding her guilty on both counts based on evidence including her multiple confessions, witness testimonies about her prior threats against Strong, and physical evidence linking her to the crime scene, such as DNA and duct tape remnants. The penalty phase began shortly thereafter, unfolding after several days. The prosecution presented victim impact evidence, including testimony from Strong's mother about the profound effects on Strong's two young children, who were ultimately adopted out following the murder. They also played recordings of Carr's statements to law enforcement, highlighting her role in the suffocation and her lack of remorse. In mitigation, Carr's defense team focused on her traumatic background, calling family members to testify about her child's sexual abuse by her father and grandfather, starting at the age of 5, which led to her temporary removal from the home by Child Services. On February 22, 2011, Judge Pope handed down the death sentence by lethal injection, aligning squarely with the jury's advisory vote. Following the sentence, Carr was transported to the Lowell Correctional Institution Annex, joining the sparse ranks of Florida's women on death row, her cell a stark enclosure where the weight of her fate settled in the quiet hours.
The sentence, and then he said, "May God have mercy on your soul." And I actually had something written down that I read afterwards about the entire thing, but it's more like shock. It doesn't really sink in because my mom was there, and my little sister, and my best friend at the time. And you know, I'm sitting there thinking, because I had already prepared myself, because I knew. I mean, everybody was talking about it. You know, they'd never had a case like this. I mean, I was convicted before I went to trial in the media. You know, in the local papers and stuff. I was already convicted. So I had already had my mindset that either way, I knew I was going to prison. It was just my family I was concerned for. So when he read the sentence and my mom just collapsed. I knew I couldn't cry. I had to be strong. Yes, my mom. So, you know, I turned around and I was like, "It's okay, it's not over. We're gonna fight this. It's okay, it's okay." So it's like you get back and because I'm from here, I grew up with a lot of people that worked at the county jail and stuff. And you can see them crying, and that's when it hit me. So it's kind of like you're in this shock, because you're just like, "That didn't happen. That didn't happen. That didn't happen."
In January 2016, the United States Supreme Court issued a landmark ruling in Hearst versus Florida, declaring the state's death penalty law unconstitutional for permitting judges to impose capital punishment based on jury recommendations that were not unanimous, a violation of the Sixth Amendment's guarantee of a fair jury trial. This decision rippled directly through Carr's case, spotlighting her non-unanimous 7-5 jury vote as a fatal flaw in the process. The Florida Supreme Court extended the Hearst ruling retroactively to select cases, sparking a wave of resentencings across the state's death row population. Faced with the prospect of a protracted new penalty phase trial, laden with costs and delays, prosecutors opted for a pragmatic resolution and consented to a life sentence. On June 6, 2017, Carr appeared once more before the court, where she was resentenced to life imprisonment without the chance of parole, a shift that lifted her from the isolation of death row and integrated her into the general prison population. As of 2026, she continues to serve this sentence within the confines of the Florida correctional system, her days marked by the monotonous routine of incarceration. Joshua Folgham's trial began in early April 2012 in the familiar confines of the Marion County Courthouse, with Circuit Judge Brian D. Lambert presiding over a courtroom where the stakes remained lethally high. The prosecution pushed for the death penalty, casting Folgham as the mastermind who enticed Strong to the trailer with false promises, bound her in a web of tape and terror, and sealed her fate through suffocation, all amid the poisonous dynamics of a love triangle driven by jealousy and bitter custody fights. His defense counsel countered by advocating for a second-degree murder conviction, stressing the impulsive heat of the moment over any cold premeditation, their arguments unfolding in a tense atmosphere, thick with legal maneuvering. On April 12, 2012, following less than 2 hours of deliberation in a sequestered room, the jury returned with convictions on both counts, dismissing the lesser charge and affirming premeditation based on a tapestry of testimonies, incriminating recordings, and evidence of Folgham's opportunistic use of Strong's credit cards in the aftermath. The penalty phase ensued the next week, with the state reiterating the aggravating circumstances akin to those in Carr's trial. The crime's entanglement with kidnapping, its heinous and cruel execution marked by Strong's drawn-out anguish, and the calculated premeditation evident in prior discussions and lures. The defense presented mitigating factors, though specifics from arguments remain sparse in public records. They emphasized aspects of Folgham's background, the relational chaos, and potential for redemption to tilt the jury towards mercy. The jury's recommendation came as life imprisonment without parole, voted 8-4, with 8 favoring life and 4 leaning toward death, a decision that spared him the ultimate penalty. At the sentencing hearing on April 25, 2012, Judge Lambert delivered the verdict in an open court, placing great weight on the jury's advisory input, as mandated by Florida law at that era. He sentenced Folgham to life without parole for murder, stacking a consecutive life term for the kidnapping, locking him away for eternity in the state's prison system. Folgham's sentence stands unaltered to this day, listener. With no major appeals yielding changes, as of 2026, his existence confined to the grim routine of his incarceration. This is where the file closes, listener. Though nothing about it is finished, the evidence has been cataloged, the testimony weighed, the sentences fixed in ink that will not fade. What remains is the residue, the kind that seeps into the walls and never leaves. There is no revelation left to uncover here, only the knowledge of what people are capable of when obsession is mistaken for love and control mistaken for necessity. The machinery of justice did what it always does. It processed bodies, statements, timelines, and motives. It translated fear into legal languages and suffering into numbered exhibits. It named the acts and assigned the punishment. Then it moved on. But, listener, justice does not restore breath to the lungs or return a woman to her children. It does not rewind the moment when escape was still possible. It simply records the damage and locks it away. Heather Strong must not be absorbed into the noise of the case. She was not the sum of what was done to her. She was a mother whose absence reshaped her children's lives in ways no sentence can address. She was a daughter whose name still echoes in a family that will always be missing one voice. She was a victim of a violence that was slow, deliberate, and indifferent to her terror. Remembering her means refusing to let her be reduced to evidence or narrative convenience. It means acknowledging that her life mattered long before it was extinguished. This has been Obscura. We document what happened because forgetting is easier and because the dead cannot argue for themselves. I thank you for listening, and keep the fire burning.